Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is Wednesday, the 2nd of May, 2012, and that can only mean one thing. It's time for our weekly chat with the International Forecaster, Bob Chapman of TheInternationalForecaster.com. Bob Chapman, as always, thank you for your time.
Well, you're very gracious in having me on the program all the time.
Yeah, grace has nothing
and
to do with it.
I enjoy it very much. Because we get on the leading edge. Unfortunately, we're not seeing much leading edge, I would say, for the past 6 weeks. There's just nothing going on.
Yes,
what do you think?
Well, I agree. I think it's kind of an eerie lull, which could mean a lot of things, but I think it's also coming up to that time of year when they're preparing for the trilateral meeting and the Bilderberg meeting and the places where the real agenda gets set for the year, so I think we might be seeing a bit of a lull before the actors have their scripts, so to speak. But on that note, I mean, there are still things that are coming across the news wire, so why don't we broach a few of them. For example, Zero Hedge has something just out fresh this morning. Eurosis is back with a bang, PMIs collapse, unemployment surges to record. So let me just read the opening of this article. It says, yesterday we poked fun of Goldman for suggesting that the reason for the late day sell-off was prudent profit-taking, as folks remember Europe isn't closed tomorrow. Turns out Goldman could not have been more right. Around 4 a.m. Eastern this morning, Europe reported a series of economic updates which showed that the European economy continues to be nothing but a slow-motion train wreck and is getting far worse. Starting with final April Eurozone manufacturing PMI, which printed at 45.9 versus an initial print of 46.0, a nine-month low with a core breakdown as follows. Italian manufacturing PMI 43.8 at a six-month low. German manufacturing PMI at a 33-month low, 46.2 versus initial 46.3. France manufacturing PMI 46.9 versus initial 47.3, which also followed Italy by recording sharpest drop in manufacturing new orders in 3 years in April, and so on, as can be seen in the chart below. And it has a little chart of the manufacturing PMI numbers. And then starts to talk about jobless rates. Germany came worse than expected, with over 19,000 more added to the jobless rolls on an estimate of a 10,000 decline. So 29,000 job discrepancy there. And it doesn't look good for the rest of the Eurozone either. So any of your thoughts on any of this type of information, Bob?
Well, first of all, I think most people don't know that they count the partially employed, part-timers, and many, many, many of the jobs that have been put on have been part-timers. That's why they go off so fast. They put in somebody for a month and then bingo, that's it. Anyway, the whole cause of that is deliberate. They know what to do to fix it. And that is all they have to do is lend money to the manufacturers in order to get some jobs going, some risk, some research, whatever, and they're not doing it. So this thing, and I had anticipated that the bankers would be lenders, and they're not. And that means the situation in employment is going to be short-lived. Inflation is not going to be as bad as anticipated. And that is going to negatively impart, take its course against the British economy as well as the U.S. economy. And you've already seen the best quarters. I think we're going to go right down to zero on the GDP for the U.S.
Right down to zero?
Well, it's only, 2.5% in the last quarter. It doesn't take much to take it down, believe me.
Well, that's certainly not cheery news for the economy. So, looking at the Eurozone specifically, I mean, is any of this PMI news particularly surprising to you?
Yes. Yes, it is. I didn't expect it to be that bad. It's fully justify my statement that the European economy at best will, oh, probably over the next four quarters, will be in the 0 to +1%, depending upon which country you look at. And overall, probably zero, because there's countries that are already minus, and Italy and Spain are two of them. And so I think we're in for a very, very deep depression. We're in a depression now, but nobody wants to believe it. Certainly in Europe and England, and in the United States too. I think we've been in depression in all those locales since a year ago, February, which is two years and a couple of months. But nobody wants to hear it. The guy that's getting closest again is Shiller, K. Shiller Institute. And the position they're in is they're getting their hard figures later, and they know that the government is lying about the figures. So that's going to throw them 6 months behind anyway.
Well, of course, the ongoing debate is about whether or not the central banks should be printing money left and right in order to try to inflate the currency and to spend their way out of the depression. And of course, well, we know what that ultimately leads to is, of course, inflation. An interesting story came across the newswires yesterday on Reuters. Inflation threat keeps Fed in check. And it notes the risk of inflation is keeping the Federal Reserve from doing more to support the U.S. economy, according to comments from several top Fed officials that reinforce the notion the central bank is happy to stand pat for now. Five policymakers weighed in on Tuesday on how the U.S. central bank intends to deal with possible threats to the economic recovery. They include volatile oil prices, Europe's debt trouble, and a looming fiscal cliff of scheduled U.S. tax increases and spending cuts. With inflation very close to the Fed's target of 2%, the officials seemed hesitant to rock the boat with more bond buying, even though unemployment remains high at 8.2%. And the article goes on to describe some of the people who were making this assessment, some Fed officials and others, talking about how the Fed is now scared about inflation, and so they might not be thinking about a QE3. But, of course, that's not really what we've been looking at. We've just been looking at a question of if, not when. I'm sorry, when, not if, for QE3. What's your take on this latest story?
Well, it's surprising, that's for sure. I think we're headed down. They decided that this is the way they want to go. Save the banks, save the lenders, and heck with everybody else.
Well, I have to be a bit cynical about the timing of this story that the Fed officials are now supposedly worried about inflation, because just earlier, last Friday, there was a story that that global stocks ended higher on Friday on strong earnings reports, but the dollar dipped against the euro and the yen as lower than expected U.S. economic data fed views that the Federal Reserve could ease policy further to boost flagging growth. So basically, this Reuters report from just a few days before was saying that people were scared the Fed was about to start a round of QE3, so the dollar was dipping. So out they come to say, don't worry, there's no QE3 on the way. So I don't know if it's just a cynical move to try to basically placate the markets.
And that's what I think it is. They got to go to QE3 in the United States. They've already done so in Europe, with the currency swaps, which in fact are loans, as simple as that. And they're just going to have to do that. I don't know what they're going to call it, but they have to do it. If they don't, then the GDP side plunges down to -5. I mean, does anybody want that?
I don't think so. And I think you hit on a key concept there, because I think it is about the optics of it. And if they can come up with a way to do this that that's slightly different than simply injecting money, or if they can call it a different name, or if they can do something like Operation Twist, I think they'll try to do something like that again. So again, the easing can come in different forms rather than simply just printing the money. But I think you're right. It has to come.
It's going to be to those who understand, a startling reminder that the world is in a depression, that the U.S. is in a depression, and it's going to get exceedingly worse. And that's why I keep on telling people who are employed, never mind those who are unemployed, put away dehydrated, freeze-dried foods. Have a water filter. Be prepared for this. I mean, if you get a year's worth of food in the house, well, you lose your job with that extra money coming in from unemployment. You can probably tough out 3 years, you know, from a food standpoint. And this is going to go on for years. This is not going to be something that is going to go away in a very quick fashion. It's not. I mean, look at the 1930s. We went from 29 to 41, and they didn't accomplish anything.
Exactly right. Well, absolutely. And it's so... Again, what do you even say to this? But that is so
well, you
true.
Know, Jim, in a situation like this, it's really perfectly in place for another war. Let's face it, and they blame everything on the war, and they'll get away with everything.
Well, we've talked about it before, and we will probably continue to talk about it, because it is absolutely true that it's the favorite way of the bankster oligarchy to blame all of the troubles on the war, and then to stimulate the economy with war, because nothing stimulates the economy like death on a mass scale. And on that note, of course, one of the big proponents of tricks up the sleeve like that is Paul Krugman, who, of course, is the Nobel laureate for economics, the distinguished Nobel laureate of the New York Times, who basically just wants the Fed to turn on the printing presses full steam. And he's the absolute number one person in the media these days arguing for the Keynesian side of the debate against people like Ron Paul, who are, of course, are advocating the Austrian side of the debate. And on that note, people might know that earlier this week, Paul versus Paul happened live on TV. There was a debate between Paul Krugman and Ron Paul on TV earlier this week. And for those of you out there who have not seen this debate, basically it went pretty much the way you thought it would go, with Ron Paul arguing for, at the very least, starting to allow legalize alternative currencies and alternatives to the Fed. And Paul Krugman basically saying that was ridiculous, and no, of course we need the Fed to be the loving central bankers over everything. And the general consensus out there on the web is that Ron Paul won the debate quite handily, but Paul Krugman is now came out with a blog post on the New York Times saying that debating face-to-face is basically useless because no one can present facts on TV, etc., etc. So basically saying that, yes, I know I lost the debate, but it doesn't matter. So it kind of played out the way you'd expect it to go. But well, Bob, what's your take on this Keynesian-Austrian debate and the way that it's portrayed in the media?
Well, I think they're trying to make it simple. And, of course, they poo-poo the Austrian side. And they always will. I mean, what the Keynesian side is, my take on Keynesian is that it is a instrument to institute corporatist fascist government. You know, and it's just like two pieces of paper. It's as simple as that. One group of people want to keep on creating money and credit, and the other people want to bring the use of running it, the use of money and credit into the economy or out of the economy in a timed atmosphere. Like, let's say a country's got a debt of 100% of GDP, and their debts are about, say, $300 billion. You don't clear them all out in one day. You move them out over a period of time, 5, 10 years, whatever it takes.
Right. Well, absolutely. So, I mean, what do you say to the people who do believe that having a strong central bank is somehow, you know, the only way it's possible to imagine the shaping of the economy, and people who don't understand that there wasn't even a Federal Reserve before 1913? How do you even explain that to them?
Well, you get your hands full. And trying to make it any simpler than what I did, it's pretty difficult. I mean, we just gave definitions to what these things are very quickly and adroitly. But there's many, many nuances to this thing. And people just don't want to or can't understand them. And that's very important in societies that do not have the educational process in place. I mean, I talk to people who have MBAs and doctorates about the two forces, which are Keynesianism and classical economics. They don't know what it's about. They have a hard time grasping it.
Well, Bob, let's shift tracks a little bit. Let's talk about an interesting tidbit that came up on CNN earlier this week. There is a new, or I guess an old witness to the RFK assassination, who is saying that there was a second shooter. And her name is Nina Rhodes Hughes, and she's just apparently just come out just recently to say that she now says with absolute conviction there was definitely a second shooter involved, and that she personally heard somewhere from 12 to 14 shots at the time that RFK was assassinated. Obviously, quite an interesting revelation, and it's I guess one can question why it took her 40 years to come out with this information, but of course we have seen the way that people have been treated in other investigations into JFK, etc., and lots of people mysteriously end up dead. So I suppose we can understand why someone would want to keep that. But your take on the RFK assassination and what really took place there in 1968?
Hi, there's so many conflicting stories. I stay away from it. Now, we know basically who did it, and that's all we need to know.
Well, it must have been, I mean, for people like myself, who I was born in the 1970s, obviously completely not in that era at all, it must have been quite an incredible, remarkable time, and not in a good way, in American politics, with JFK and Malcolm X and MLK and RFK all being assassinated within a few short years. What was it really like at that time, and what was the political climate?
Well, I think everybody still believed in the system, generally speaking. And there were those of us who knew what the government was up to. We knew why Jack Kennedy was killed, and most people didn't. They know now. And so there was great political turmoil.
Well, in one sense, that's kind of depressing, obviously. But in another sense, it's almost hopeful, because it seems to indicate that people are at least starting to wake up and to learn and to question the system. Do you see that kind of difference now between what people are into now as opposed to, you know, 50 years ago?
I think that the startling revelations that we're seeing are, I think that they're not important to today's current times. In the end, everybody's going to know the truth, that desires to know. And that's okay, but it doesn't pertain to today for most people. It certainly does for me, because the same guys are doing the same thing over and over again.
Well, it does seem to just go on and on. And of course, we've seen an escalation of events from Ruby Ridge and Waco to OKC bombing to 9/11, which makes me shudder to think at what may come next. And of course, we've seen a ramp up in the talk about possible terrorist events in the one-year anniversary of the Osama bin Laden assassination. And the fear, of course, cranked up to full blast at all times. Any thoughts on what you think might be coming next in terms of the escalation of these types of events?
Well, I think you'll see Syria, and then you'll see Iran. And you'll see the same kind of warfare. I don't think they use atomic weapons, nuclear devices. They may, but I don't think so. And I think Russia and China will be involved. And that's the way I think it will work out.
Well, that's pretty horrific.
The only card they got left.
Yeah. But, I mean, that ultimately means World War III.
Well, they want to get rid of another maybe 100, 200 million people. Just like in Africa. Why do you think they have all the wars there? Why do you think they leave dictators in place? You tell the dictator, go out and kill 300,000 of them. They go right out and do it.
Well, that's a pretty sour note to leave things on. On a more positive note, what can people or should people be doing to combat this, what we see going on in the world right now?
As I mentioned earlier, dehydrated, freeze-dried foods, water filter, weapons. I mean, why do you think they've got the TSA and Homeland Security preparing for another war? I mean, they ordered up, what was it, 400 million rounds of .40 caliber ammunition for a group that's never been trained in combat, nor people control, nor can they shoot straight.
Well, certainly something to give people pause for thought, I would assume. And yes, you're right, 450 million rounds, according to some estimates. But yes, 450 million hollow point bullets ordered recently by the Department of Homeland Security. So should at least give people a bit of concern about what they're up to with that. And you're right. I mean, when there's no accountability over a government, I'm sure they can do whatever they want in terms of getting people ready for the rollout of the police state in full form. And of course, we do know that the NATO/G20 summits will be taking place in a couple of weeks here in the United States, and then followed up by the Bilderberg Conference, which looks like it's going to be taking place near Washington again this year. So it's going to be a very exciting month.
Yeah, all the way in. Starting probably next week, we're going to start seeing the fur fly in Europe. That'll carry over for months and months, maybe even years.
That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, and who's going to pay for all this?
Well, I guess generations yet unborn, if the people who want to enslave the world in debt servitude get their way. But let's make sure that they don't do that. And of course, the best way to ensure our future liberty and prosperity is, first of all, to understand what's going on, and thus to get prepared for what's going on, as you've said a few times tonight. And on that note, of course, one of the best ways to be prepared is to be forewarned, and thus forearmed. So let's talk about your International Forecaster newsletter for people out there who haven't heard of it and don't know how to get a copy.
The forecast is about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues, all over the world. We publish by email on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the net. Everything you need to know each week is in that publication. If you'd like a free introductory copy, go to theinternationalforecaster.com. Forecaster is forecaster.com. For those of you who want a question answered, we answer everyone. Or if you'd like a copy of the two reports, or if you would like a copy of our latest gold and silver share recommendations, you can email us, and that address is bob@intforecaster.com. bob@intforecaster.com. And for those of you who would like to call in toll free, that number is 877-479-8178. 877-479-8178. Not only can you get copies there, but you can also take advantage of a special offer that they have made for the last few years, actually. And the special offer allows one to receive a free one-year subscription to the publication. And you should take advantage of it at those rates, which is virtually nothing, to get the publication.
Bob Chapman, always a pleasure, always informative. I'm looking forward to next week.
Well, thank you, and thanks for all your help.